And welcome to the Imperial MBA Women Podcast. I'm Rachel Tunde, and in this episode, we are discussing imposter syndrome. Imposter syndrome was classified by psychologists Pauline Rose Clance and Suzanne Imes as a phenomenon experienced by both men and women and is characterized by the feeling that our successes can be attributed to mere luck, rather than our own skills or qualifications. I've personally experienced imposter syndrome throughout both my academic and professional careers, and I'm sure some of our listeners have as well. Today, I will be having a conversation with Fiona Sanford and Nikki Emerson about their own experiences with imposter syndrome in academia and the sports industry, respectively.
Okay, so first we're going to be talking with Fiona Sanford about her vast experience and career in academics. Fiona, can you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Fiona Sanford. I currently at Imperial, I run the executive leadership journey for our executive MBAs, which is a really joyous thing to do because it's very much about practicing the soft skills that are taught by faculty in a much more structured way. So we really are bringing in a lot of people who are walking the walk in business and encouraging our EMBA students and participants to really practice communication skills, practice giving feedback, practice having difficult conversations, all the leadership skills that are so necessary for senior executives. So that's been great fun. Before that, I was interim associate dean, vice dean of education before Leila Guerra came. And before that, I was at London Business School for many years, and before that at the LSE. So I've done the rounds of London institutions.
Yeah, I think with an introduction like that, for me, it's hard to imagine that you've personally had experience with imposter syndrome. But I think that's what we're discussing today. So I would love to hear about your personal experience with imposter syndrome and how or any skills that you've developed to help overcome it.
I think it's a fascinating topic. And when you say, have you experienced it? I have very rarely met anybody who has not experienced it. I think it sits on your shoulder. I often feel, because I am about to retire from Imperial, and I often feel that as I retire, what should be said about me was, well, she got away with it, which is often the feeling that you have, because imposter syndrome is such a dominating fact. I think as you get towards the end of your career, or you get more senior, one thing that you very, very much helps you is you realize that everybody is suffering from some form of imposter syndrome and nobody knows everything. But I think I'm of the generation of women who, I was an undergraduate before the Equal Pay Act passed, which just shows my great age. And then university appointment services, as they were grandiosely called then, could do one of two things. They could run two bulletins, a men's bulletin, jobs bulletin, a women's job bulletin, or they could run one and you would see the salary for men would be X and the salary for women would be X minus of 10, sometimes 20%. So when, I know, then that was legal and that was wow. The world we grew up with. And as the Equal Pay Act was coming in, I remember having endless discussions with what was then, I suppose, my parents' generation, who thought this was ridiculous and it could never possibly work. I think that did, if you like, fire many of us to think, well, blow you, I'm jolly well going to succeed and prove that you can't do that. But permanently, I think sitting on, or certainly sitting on my shoulder and sitting on the shoulder of everybody who I've spoken to about this, women in particular, is imposter syndrome and wondering, does somebody know anything that, do I, you know, am I asking a stupid question? Will people think me daft? Should I even be here? I think that is very much what many of us feel.
Yeah.
I think in terms of thinking about how you overcome it, I think several things have enormously helped me. One was doing voluntary work in the not-for-profit sector, where very often your role is to ask, we in Scotland call it the daft lassie question. So you're supposed to ask the question that you're not supposed to be the expert. You are there to ask the question nobody else has thought of. And that is incredibly freeing because you're not supposed to be the expert. For 11 years, I was the patient advocate on our governance ethics committee, which very much had the great and the good on it. And it was my job to ask, the naive question, the question nobody had thought of. And you are sitting there, and that enormously you can feel this is imposter syndrome. And occasionally people will get rather cross at being, particularly great experts, you know, world-leading scientists and doctors can not like being questioned like that. But when you know it's your role to do it, it's very freeing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think I personally work in the nonprofit sector. And so I came in as a fellow meant to do quality improvement. I work in Malawi, and that was like the thing. Like, it was, you come in, you try to see where we have gaps. And as much as that was really challenging from the conversations that were had, it was really freeing for me, especially being young, especially being a woman, and early on in my career, just being like, okay, well, I don't understand how this works. Please explain to me how this works. And it just made me a lot more comfortable just asking those questions and having those conversations instead of being like, okay, well, is it going to look weird if I don't know, or if I ask this question, I look silly, you know? That makes a ton of sense to me. Yeah.
I think it's incredibly freeing. And I think the other thing it teaches you is that nobody, absolutely nobody on this planet knows it all. They may have a very, very deep knowledge of their particular subject, but they will have missed something. Mm-hmm. And there is just the kind of common sense approach, or the human approach, or the empathetic approach, or the lay approach, or the communications approach that they will have missed. Mm-hmm. And I think when you have that experience, it can help you enormously in your professional life, because you realize that even in areas where, again, you are supposed to have a great deal of expertise and you're with other people who have a great deal of expertise, absolutely nobody knows at all. And that's really very freeing. There are a lot of people who are very good at pretending they know it all. And that can be very intimidating, particularly at the beginning bit of your career. I'm not sure it is something you would want to look forward to, but it is enormously empowering. And I've had this discussion with many friends and colleagues of my generation, that when you get to be at the, I'm going to retire quite soon point, maybe some, you know, in your 50s and older, you care much less about being caught out, because you know that there is no such thing as the total expert. And that's very, very, very freeing. Yeah, so I think that's a very helpful thing to do. The other technique I've often used, well, two other techniques that I've often used, and I've often coached students to use. The first one I think is really quite easy, and it's a variety of fake it till you make it, which is to think, okay, what would somebody who I really admire, what would they do or say in these circumstances? Now, looking around imperial women, it's really quite easy to do that. You can sit there and think, right, what would Alice Gast say? If you ever watch her in action. I don't know, in the business school, if you know, the newly endamed, our new dame, Professor Carol Proper. I worked with her very closely. She's an economist of some note. I've been in meetings with her lots. I've loved watching her in action. And when I've been in difficult situations, particularly with a non-executive hat on, and have seen accidental or sometimes not accidental sexism, racism, whatever, I've sat there, and it can be easy to think, oh, I'll just sit this one out. But then I've often thought to myself, well, what would Carol say? And that's, in a way, has given me the, okay, I'll be Carol for a minute. I'll just put her hat on. And that will allow me to call out behavior that I don't think should be there. And I think when you are at the beginning bit of your career, having some people in your mind, could be somebody in the public eye, Baroness Hale or Kamala Harris or somebody like that, but better if you've seen somebody in action and you think, okay, what would they do? And it can be a useful tool. Have you tried that ever?
Yeah, and I think that like speaks a lot to the importance of having women in positions of that level, especially for people that are younger and early on in their career. I think when people say like it's important, like representation matters, like you can see it as a box of diversity, or, you know, ticking that box, but it's also really important for what it instills in people and how we see ourselves as women. And, you know, that people don't necessarily see that, but when you put it that way, I really think that that resonates in that way of, like, you know, referencing Kamala Harris. The inauguration was 2 days ago at the time of recording this. And so I'm American, seeing that as an American woman, never before seeing a female vice president, that was incredible for me, right? And so knowing that there's now been a female vice president changes my perspective on how I see myself as a woman in that way. And I think that
is really incredible. And that makes a ton of sense in terms of how to see yourself and how you see other women. I really like that a lot. Yeah.
This may not be relevant, but I love it. I was listening to Americast about the inauguration. And of course, everybody's eyes were on their, standing out on their stalks when Lady Gaga came on. And wasn't she wonderful? But then someone, I think it was Emily Maitlis, linked that back to, I don't know if you remember, our Supreme Court judge, Baroness Hale, who had to give a very important judgment about whether Parliament had acted lawfully or not. And she also had the most amazing, eye-catching brooch on that she says gives her great confidence. And there was a link somehow to Lady Gaga and her enormous brooch and her very out there style. So I think, I mean, again, listening to podcasts with Baroness Hale, who is the most supremely confident, able Supreme Court judge. And she has been talking about how wearing something, or for her, it's her amazing brooches, just gives her the confidence to act in a particular way. And I think many of us in the past, I remember when I got a fairly senior job at the LSE, I didn't take my jacket off for a year, because I was usually in a room full of men. And that was my comfort blanket. Not that that should necessarily be the case, but I think finding what your comfort blanket is, whether it's Lady Hale's brooch or your jacket or whatever, can be helpful sometimes. Do you find?
Yes, definitely. I think, yeah, anything that makes you feel comfortable, if it's a work environment, if it's colleagues that you can lean on. What you were saying about comfort also kind of reminded me about how women can help instill that in each other. I think there was a story when President Obama was in office about the women on his staff would repeat what another woman had said until it had been picked up in a meeting, because so often a woman would say something and it would just get dismissed. So then they just came up with a strategy of, we're going to repeat whatever anyone says, we're just going to repeat it until it gets picked up in the meeting. And I think that by feeding each other in that way, you also kind of help mitigate the effects of imposter syndrome, because you're like, okay, this person has my back. They're going to help me get my point across. Or, you know, if it's wearing a brooch that makes you feel empowered, or just knowing that there are things that can help you do that. And I think that knowing what your comfort blanket is really touches upon being self-aware and knowing yourself and how you operate and how you react. And I think something else that comes up with imposter syndrome is that it's often hard to differentiate between like people's behavior towards us and what we're internalizing as unfair treatment, and letting that become imposter syndrome. So I wonder, what questions can we ask ourselves to make sure we're recognizing whether it's internal or external influences that are causing us to question our ability? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. And I think there's a really, well, there's quite a close correlation between perfectionism and imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And this is something I've seen in students, particularly MBA students, that in order to get to an MBA at a place like Imperial, you've usually, for most of your life, you've been defined as clever. And that can be a terrible spectre on your shoulder. Because if you've been defined as a little girl or as growing up as being a clever one, then when somebody inevitably comes along who is cleverer than you, depending on how you define clever, but you know, there will always be always be somebody who is better at you about something, it can be very, very, very destroying. And I think one of the first ways of overcoming imposter syndrome is to let go of that perfectionism and accepting that there will be people who are better at you at, I don't know, economics or maths or whatever, or finance. But, you know, there you are. You're better at communication. You're better at seeing data and presenting it in a much more understandable way. You're better at other things, and nobody has the full picture. But I think if you've been defined as clever, it can be a shadow. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, a lot of sense. Personally, that resonates with me a lot. I think just wanting to be really good at things. And I think somehow in society we value being really good at everything. And it's been pitched as like being well-rounded. And, you know, even when you're applying for university, you have to list your extracurricular activities and prove how, you know, well-rounded and unique you are. And that can automatically make you feel like you have to be good at everything, and you can't necessarily show that you're not good at everything. And it's instilled in us from early on. And I think that, yeah, that definitely can. Yeah.
I would love to see us instilling, and I didn't do it with my daughters, but I'm trying to do it with my granddaughters. Let's be rubbish at something. Now, I love playing tennis. Quite a bit of my social life is about playing tennis. I am bad at tennis. I have people who would rather not partner me at tennis. Fortunately, I have a very, very understanding husband who partners me at mixed doubles, and he's quite good. But I think embrace something that you are not particularly good at, but it's fun, I think, can be a great learning thing. The other thing, it was a real eye-opener to me, and it came perhaps later in my career than it should have done, when I heard the phrase delivery through others. And I realized that the whole business of making something happen very often happened because you surrounded yourself with people with very different skills to you. And you very often hired people who were better than you. And that takes a certain amount of confidence, because you can be very nervous about hiring people who are better than you. But if you do it, goodness me, you can get fantastic results. So the ability to let go of feeling that you have to, A, as you say, you have to be good at everything because it's been instilled in you. You are the clever one. And B, you have to deliver it yourself. And a really, really clever thing to do, and I'm trying to think who talks about this really well. At Imperial, if you watch Leila Guerra, who is the vice dean, who I know very, very well of old, she is very, very good at appointing people who have different skills from her, who have better skills from her. She wants them to help her deliver what the vision of the school is, and she wants them to stay on message. But she's good at appointing people who are better than her at some things. And I think that's a very, very important skill to learn. And I wish I'd learned that earlier. But it takes a certain amount of confidence to do it.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that's framed as humility. But when you put it in terms of confidence, like it is about confidence, because it's about, okay, I recognize that this is what I bring to the table and this person can bring this other thing. But I think when it's framed as humility in a lot of ways of, you know, be humble enough to, which it is, but it's also about that internal confidence. So it's maybe more of an external humility, but to you it's your internal, like, I feel secure enough in myself and what I know and what my skills are and what I bring to the table to move in this direction for the greater good or the bigger picture that I'm a part of, you know. And I think when you frame it that way, it kind of opens things up in a lot of ways of possibility.
And I think if you can inspire loyalty amongst your team by looking after them, by having their back, they'll have your back. And then the project will be delivered and you look fantastic. Mm-hmm. So never mind. I think humility is, I think it's quite a dangerous concept for many people, because it can feel as if you should be less than you are. And I'm not sure that that's right. I think appointing people who are better than you demands a huge amount of confidence in yourself, but it can deliver fantastic results. I quite famously, my attention to detail is never that great. On the other hand, one thing I can do is look at the bigger picture, and I can look at, as I spend my life with my other hat on, look at the incredibly complex spreadsheets and focus on the numbers that really matter. But I absolutely need to know that there are people around me who are paying attention to the detail and who will drill down into those figures and who will pull me up if I, you know, forget something, because otherwise it just won't work. So I think recognizing that different talents, a wide variety of talents, are needed to deliver true success is very helpful. So I think perfectionism is one thing to try and let go of. And the other thing is to try very hard to be the sort of team player who has the confidence to appoint people and encourage people who are better than you. And I think the sad thing is fake it till you make it. I'm a huge fan of that. And part of fake it till you make it, and I just a slight anecdote here, and I have been called out on this. I've always found it enormously helpful to be new, because if you're new in a role, you have at least a year to ask some fairly daft questions. And I've always milked that for as much as I could. I remember being called out again at the LSE by the academic registrar, who said, come on, Fiona, you're not new anymore. Stop doing that. Because it had been enormously helpful. The other great thing, which is true in so many bits of life, is, and people will often say, have a mentor. I'm a fan of have a cheerleader, have somebody who will cheer you on, who knows you well enough to know what knows what your strengths are, knows where the cracks are too, knows whether, you know, you're not so good at detail or that you are too much of a perfectionist, and will help you, coach you through that, but will also cheer you on. Because the classic thing about imposter syndrome, and we know this, it's so widely quoted, is that many men, not all men, because men get imposter syndrome too, very, very much so, but a lot of men will apply for a job if they meet, half or less of the criteria. Many, many women will not consider it unless they can tick every box. And you need somebody who will be your cheerleader, who will say, oh, come on, of course you can do that. And, you know, you could, I'm sure you could develop that skill. So you need somebody who's going to cheer you on. And finding that as much as a mentor, I think is very, very important.
All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for.
Well, it's been lovely to talk to you. Really
lovely
nice
to talk to you too. It's been really great. Thank you so much.
Good.
Next, we're going to be speaking with Nikki Emerson about her career in the sports industry. Nikki, can you please introduce yourself?
I'm Nikki Emerson. I'm head of business development at England Rugby. And prior to that, I did a similar role for the Premier League for 4 years. And I've worked for Liverpool Football Club as well, and for the Olympics when they were in London. So lots of sport. And alongside that, I was a professional athlete for 10 years competing on the track and in marathon for Team GB.
Awesome. That's great. So we're talking about imposter syndrome today, as you know. So could you just share briefly your personal experience with imposter syndrome? How or what skills have you used to overcome it personally?
Yeah, I was so interested when Sam messaged me with this topic, because it's something that I really struggled with, particularly earlier in my career when I was making the switch from sort of athlete who had a job on the side to career person who did some athletics and was kind of petering that out. And for me, it really drove me to try and overachieve. And I was actually quite defensive because I was always trying to prove to everyone else that I did deserve to be in the role that I was in. And I think particularly being both disabled and a woman plays into that a bit, because there was always, you know, am I the kind of positive discrimination hire? Is that part of it? Particularly when I was competing a lot, it was kind of, is it just helpful for my team to have someone who can actually talk as an athlete rather than them needing me to be there because of the skills that I have in business? And actually what made me really snap out of that was a conversation with someone I didn't even know particularly well. And I was talking about my career development and saying that I'd worked for two guys in particular who were good friends with one another. I'd been really lucky to follow them between their roles, and they'd sort of rehired me to work in their teams. And this person I was talking to said, well, I don't think that the reason you are where you are is because essentially two insecure guys wanted to hire someone younger than them to support them in their team. I was like, actually, I suppose that is really what I've been saying for all these years. It's a little bit ridiculous. So now I take that feeling of, okay, maybe I don't know how to do this particular part of my role, or maybe this job that I've been given is a bit of a stretch. And I try and really use that to learn. And it's really important to me to be honest up front when I don't know something or when something is new, but equally to make it clear that I believe that I have the skills to overcome it. I'm not asking for help. I'm just flagging that this is new. But it is a work in progress, because I'm sure everyone has that moment where you just feel really anxious and you think, maybe I can't do this, actually. Maybe I should just throw in the towel and, you know, find someone else to do it.
That part that you said about being defensive really resonated with me. It was something that actually came up in like a lot of my performance reviews at work. And I kept being like, I think I'm just saying what, like, whatever. And then when I dug into it with one of my managers, he finally just like dug into it with me. And it was just that I didn't want to feel like I didn't know what I was doing.
And I freaked out and got defensive because I was like, well, I don't know the answers. You kind of touched on this, but like the sports industry is like highly competitive in a lot of ways, both on the court, on the field, but also within the organizations and the businesses that run them. So what has your experience taught you about succeeding in that kind of environment? And like you mentioned, it's laid back, things are out in the open, but like what has helped you succeed in that and using the culture of competition as a positive rather than comparing yourself to others?
I think the competitive side is quite interesting because for me, for most of my career until 2018, I was also racing on the track or in marathons. And so although the sports industry is very competitive sort of to get into and to an extent once you're in, I got in quite early and knew that I didn't want to leave there. But for me, the competition that I had in the office was such a sort of mild form compared to what was on the track. People would get really intensely obsessed about, you know, who's done more deals, what's the commission that people have earned, particularly when I was working in football. Thankfully, now that's not a way in which we remunerate people in rugby, but in that outcome, people are really living and dying by the numbers that they brought in. Whereas for me, yes, that was important because it's a part of your income and it is part of the way that the business recognizes your success. But at the weekends, I would be going and literally, you know, trying to get onto a podium. And so when you've got competition that is that outright, somehow the office side of things just was never as challenging for me, I guess. I didn't struggle so much, or maybe I was just so used to competing all the time that it almost just gets a bit wearing. So I've always been really collaborative in the office, almost to a fault, you know, not calling up successes that I've maybe been more integral to because it's always like the team's done this or my boss has been really helpful, all of that. So I suppose almost that avoidance of competition probably plays into the imposter side a little bit for me because it's almost you don't want to call yourself out so much in case you actually weren't really as central to what has just happened than that you think you are. But also the competition never mattered to me in the office quite as much. It will be interesting to see now that I don't have the competition outside of the office, whether I suddenly become like really, really aggressive about numbers and things, but hopefully it won't happen.
That's really interesting. And I sometimes see, there's no science behind what I'm about to say, but I feel like I've seen a lot of women be more collaborative in the office. And I to like our previous discussion we were having, like, I wonder if you've seen that, especially in like a male dominated industry, of like the competition being more like amplified among your male colleagues.
There's the testosterone.
Yeah, something like that. I feel like a lot of the times it's like expected of women to be collaborative and work in a team and like be less competitive. And when you're competitive, it almost comes off a certain way or is read a certain way. And I wonder if that's, I mean, obviously you just said you're not super competitive in the office, but like if you've seen it in other female colleagues or, you know, in terms of like how people, discussions like that come up at all. I'd be curious.
Yeah, they do. And they kind of come up on two sides. So on the sort of women and competition side, my boss has jokingly said a couple of times, oh, it's fine, we'll put you onto that meeting or that negotiation because we know that you love a fight. So when it comes to kind of competing against the other side almost in the negotiation, totally up for the competition. It's just not so internal. And I have found that with other women that I've worked with, that there seems to be almost a switch where it's like you've got your we're in competition, we're in negotiations, we're on opposite sides of the table, and then, you know, we're hanging out together, we feel like we can learn from the other. I mean, I have some really close friends who are women that I've met in quite combative business situations, realize that they're more experienced than me and I want to learn from them, and then we've gone for coffee and all of that. Whereas I haven't really seen that with my male colleagues so much. It's almost like, you know, we've had our fight and we are on opposite sides, so that's kind of that. But then the flip side of it is from the men that I've got to know really well through work, it's really surprising how much imposter syndrome seems to affect them. So actually, when I was interviewing my boss for the leadership essay that we do as part of the GMBA, he mentioned that he'd never felt like he deserved the role that he was in and was always felt like he had to prove himself because he's quite young for the role. I look at him and I think, wow, you've achieved so much. I've worked for him in three different jobs and always thought that he's been brilliant. And it's actually changed the way in which I work with him. It's almost, I feel more of a need to encourage him and tell him when he's done a really good job. Because it's quite often that a manager will send something out to the team saying, hey guys, you've had a really good year. And it's now, in the past, I might not have responded. Whereas now I'll make sure I go back and say, you did a really good job leading us, or this particular thing was great. Because now I understand that he needs that building up, which I wouldn't have known before. And I'm an absolute sucker for any book that's about, that kind of links sport to business. So I've been reading a couple recently, and it's been quite interesting. So it's The Captain Class and Legacy are the two that kind of came to mind when I was thinking about this topic. And they're about essentially what makes leaders of teams really successful. And there's a lot of points about being the water carrier or sweeping the shed, depending which book you're reading. And it really talks about how all leaders should almost suffer from imposter syndrome a bit. The good leader is never the one who actually thinks they're really good and they deserve to be there and they don't doubt themselves ever. And I've really seen that in the kind of good male leaders that I've worked with. So I don't think it's such a female thing as I always kind of believed in the past. Maybe we're just more open about it.
A big part of my job now is like mentoring other managers into roles. And I think it's a really challenging thing sometimes. And it, like you said, it'd be very easy to just be like, nope, I want someone I can like shift things to. I don't have to think about it. They'll send me a report and it'll be fine. But I think it is really helpful for people. Like, we've all had people that have mentored us and helped us develop, right? And so like paying that forward in a way with your team is really valuable and like does, you know, help someone say like, oh, I can grow. It's not that I'm unqualified, or it's not that I can't do this job, and that's okay. It, like, in terms of your team, are there like any specific steps you've taken in terms of like your management style, or like anything you've done with them, or if when you've seen it in someone you supervise or something like that?
Yeah, I think I probably in the past was quite bad at this, because even though I knew that I didn't, or it probably almost came into that kind of aggressive response to defending me potentially feeling as though I wasn't 100% good at my job. And so if I had a direct report who was struggling, I'd kind of worry that we would then not necessarily achieve as a team. And I expected such high commitment and such high achievement that it wasn't necessarily fair on someone that I brought in so that they could develop. And also someone who might just have different life goals and different sort of feelings of what's important. And I think actually lockdown and working from home and COVID and all of that hopefully made me better at working with my team, because I now recognize that not everybody has, you know, achieving some particular thing. So for me, commercial director of the Olympics is always what I've said that I wanted to achieve. I work with people now who don't have that goal there. And it's actually understanding that, where it's like, I want to support them to do the best that they can in their current role, but actually pushing them to overachieve isn't necessarily fair, because it's not necessarily where they want to go with their life. So that's what I try and do now, is really just work with my team and make it clear to them that they can tell me if there are things that they don't feel comfortable with. And yes, it means that you end up spending a lot more time helping your team to develop. You know, I used to just have 2 half-hour catch-ups with my direct reports, and now it's pretty much daily we catch up, and it's better for everyone, but it's quite a change and it is a lot of additional work. So I can see why some managers don't do that, but then I think that does just foster, you know, oh my gosh, I'm not good enough, but my manager doesn't really want to hear it, so how am I ever going to get better, which is kind of an impossible situation.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you said that, like, the pandemic is almost like opened your eyes to like how you can do that better, because I think we're all kind of in a vulnerable state now, right? Like, no one is in their normal, no one is in like what they feel comfortable doing. And so you're kind of forced to be like, how are you doing? Like, my manager at my job like implemented like a weekly touch base with like our global team, because we're all over the world. And now we like talk every Monday for 30 minutes. And we never did that before, because we were all over, like, yeah. Where some people were in the same office, but we didn't do that before as a team. And now and it's not a meeting where we talk about anything other than like, what's your weekly highlight? How have you been doing? Like, and I find things out about people that I never would have talked about before. And so I think, in a way, as weird as it's been, you feel very distant from people, but you've also like been forced to like have conversations with people you probably wouldn't have had in a normal setting. And so I totally agree that it's been odd in a lot of ways from a management perspective, but it's also been really good in a lot of ways, because it forces those conversations.
Yeah, I think once you've seen the inside of someone's house, and particularly with younger team members, or even, you know, I don't have a separate office space. So when you've got people who are essentially working in their bedroom, you're actually seeing such a personal side of them that I think it does help people to open up a bit more, which I found really, really good. And it's also, so my boss has put up on the wall behind him the front pages of every, obviously the front page of the Times from every day when we've done a big deal, or there's been something big that has kind of, in reality, both of us have worked on most of these things, but his big achievements. So he's got the first day of the Olympics, the last day of the Olympics, when it talked about the fact that we'd made a profit and all of this, and then big things that he did with Team GB. And that's actually quite helpful, I think, both for him to see his own achievements all the time, but also for the team, because I think somehow you respect him even more. I already did, to be honest, but you do when you can see all of that. You're like, wow, actually seeing inside this person's house and seeing the things that they've achieved up there is amazing, and you just wouldn't see it before. And then like a dog or a child or something comes in and you see the vulnerable side.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think I really like that. I thought that idea of putting up the achievements is a really cool one.
I wish that I'd saved the front covers of newspapers. You have to really know you're going to do that from quite early on in your career.
Right, you have to decide, like, I'm going to be successful and have these things. Yeah,
exactly. That's cool.
That's awesome. But yeah, no, I totally agree. So yeah, I think that's all we had time for today, but thank you so much for taking the time. This was a really great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
No, it's great to chat to you. I love how we come from such different environments and industries and everything else, but the same themes come out everywhere. So hopefully it'll prove interesting for people across all industries. We'll see.
Me too. Yeah.
Thanks, Rachel.
Once again, thank you to Fiona and Nikki for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please follow or subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast across Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and we will be back with the next episode in 2 weeks' time. If you'd like to find out more or join the Imperial MBA Women Network, connect with us on LinkedIn or Instagram. See you next time.